Hello and welcome to episode 18 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am the bored man and my name is Graham Lee. This episode is related to an essay that I posted today in the Small Talk issue of the Programmatica Ipsum, a monthly magazine that I run with Adrian Kosmachevsky. In my contribution to the issue on Smalltalk, I posited the idea that object-oriented programming wasn't the big shift that Alan Kay expected it to be. Not because it didn't take off, not because it didn't succeed. A lot of modern programming makes use of object-oriented programming or responds to it. The recent resurgence in functional programming over, say, the last 20 years has been motivated by people who are disappointed at what's happened with object-oriented programming, even though object-oriented programming has enabled essentially the entire Java ecosystem, web browsers, you know, modern internet and web technologies, modern operating systems, modern graphical user interface libraries, and so on. But I still say that it was a blue plane improvement on structured programming, because these already showed us modularity and therefore encapsulation and localization of code and data structures. He's already showed us composability and reusability. And object-oriented programming gave us a way to think about organizing our modules. But it wasn't a pink plane enhancement. It wasn't an order of magnitude increase in our capability or a redefinition of the problem or the solution that was so great that it introduced a completely different approach with its entirely different problems. And I've laid out the argument for that in my essay for De Programmatica Ipsum, which is linked in the show notes. What I want to do in this episode is to not argue the converse. I don't want to say here, well, like, actually object-oriented programming is a step out of the plane of what we were doing and it is a complete shift in the way of working. What I want to say is that it's the object-oriented thought process that is the massive step out, that is the translation into a different plane, that is taking programming in a completely different direction, but that you can't constrain that to your programmers. And also to bring up the idea that this is something we've seen in a lot of other transitions in software engineering, where there's a new idea or buzzword or technology or hype, and it's given to the programmers to implement within an organization that largely stays working the way it was before. And so therefore doesn't get to realize the benefits of using that thought process, because there are no benefits, there are only the pains of mapping it where it's applied in the engineering domain into whatever existing or traditional processes and practices are being used elsewhere. So object-oriented programming is not the pink plane idea. It is not orthogonal to the way we're working, because object-oriented programming is programming. And because programming, whether through the object-oriented paradigm, the functional paradigm, the structured paradigm, has remained the translation of a business process into a sequence of instructions that can be executed by a computer, even where we're using concurrency to enable parallelism, we're just saying there are multiple sequences that can be carried out with overlapping temporal relationships. Look at any of the books on managing an object-oriented software company in the 80s. You know, just as in the 2000s, everyone knew that their company had to be agile. So in the sort of late 80s and into the 90s, everyone knew that their software organization had to be object-oriented. That it wasn't just a technology change. It wasn't just adopt this programming language. It was adopt objects as your management structure. But now, take that idea, that information, and look for evidence that this actually happened. If you look at the way that business analysis was being done in an object-oriented organization, an object-oriented programming team, you would see UML by the time that everything collapsed down to UML. You would probably see a progenitor of UML. So you might see something like Object-Oriented Design with Applications by Grady Booch, which describes what has become known as the Booch method, but that leaves the question of analysis alone. It says there are various ways of doing analysis, and structured analysis is quite a common thing, but you could also consider entity relationship modeling or other analysis techniques. So there isn't a way for objects to get into working out what your customer wants or working out what the problem is that you're trying to solve. You only get objects when you come to analyze not the problem, because that's what the analysis is doing, that's what the analysis phase is doing. When you come to analyze how you're going to translate that into software. So it's only when you come to solution design that you're going to start translating this presumably structured collection of requirements into something that has classes and hierarchy and all of the things that went with the Booch method. Now, even though it's pre-agile, Booch definitely recognizes that software is best done in an iterative sense. He very quickly sort of pulls down the idea of the waterfall methodology and has all sorts of arrows going forwards and backwards and iterations and evolutions. And so it's clear that there's going to be some interface between the analysis, which is structured or entity relationship or business process flow modeling or whatever it is, and the solution design, which is object oriented, and that this is going to be bi-directional, but with no conceptual synergy, with none of what you might call impedance matching between these two things. What you're going to end up with is a lot of translation, a lot of discussion, and potentially a lot of confusion in this now very important interface layer. Or you might see something like Wirth-Sprock, Wilkerson and Wiener's Designing Object-Oriented Software, which is one of the other sort of precursor methods to object-oriented analysis and design with UML. And the process would begin something like this: read and understand the specification. That's sentence one in the process summary. Extract noun phrases from the specification and build a list. That's another early stage. So we've already got, again, the specification by the time that we've come to try and work out what it is that we're going to build. So again, we've got translation. We've got this idea that we're being given a design which is in some sort of sequential format, which is reasonable because, you know, we talk about business processes because we model them as processes. We don't have objects with various activities or with various responsibilities for the most part, because our businesses are entirely controlled top down in a hierarchical fashion. That even if we say it is the responsibility of this employee to perform this task, the fact that they have that task and the fact that it fits into what the business is doing is part of an overall process that's been designed from the top. An example of system requirements in the Wurst-Brock method would still say something like this for a text editor. The online documentation system is a tool to allow people who work with a computer to document their work online. The system will run on a computer with a bitmap display, a keyboard and a mouse. The computer provides a standard windowing system and it can be configured to connect to a printer. Requirements. Users of the system must be able to 1. Enter and edit text. 2. Import graphics from other sources. 3. View the document in Windows. And so on. We've got a list of requirements and they are things that a user can do to a document. Example. The online documentation system edits documents. The document consists of 0 or more headings or paragraphs on pages. Yes, that is definitely written in a way that's going to allow the reader to imagine some objects and some classes that would be useful. But it is very much a document of what a user does to a computer system, which is reasonable because that's how we work with computer systems, but isn't a document about what the computer system does to other bits of the computer system, or what the computer system does to the user, or what the user does to or with or thanks to the help of another user or another human who doesn't use the computer system. There's no independent agency other than user who has sort of godlike control over this system, does things and the system obeys. So even after you merge all of these methodologies together and you get the rational unified process and UML, the unified modeling language, UML still doesn't have, strictly speaking, an object-oriented way of representing the world in which the software interacts. There is the use case diagram, which has users as little stick people and the system as an opaque box, and then arrows between the stick figures and the box saying what the people can do. But then you ask for a bit more detail and what you get is the use case document, which is a structured hierarchical piece of text written by a structured hierarchical manager, or at least absorbed from the brain of this structured hierarchical manager by a business analyst, saying first the user will log into the system. Exception case 1, if the user presents an incorrect password, then the system returns to the login page. Exception 1.1, if the user expresses the incorrect password 3 times, then the workstation is locked and the administrator must unlock it. See administrator unlock workflow. We're still talking about workflows and processes. And then bringing all of that forward into the 21st century, all that we did was note that it's very hard to get these documents correct first time. Note that we're going to need all of this evolution and iterative back and forth between the programmers building the system, or at least the engineering team building the system, and the analysts or customers or product owners who are constructing the requirements documents. And we say, well, let's make the requirements documents shorter so that they are deliberately more ambiguous and we can not bother editing them. We're just going to have conversations about what we think we mean and then allow that iteration and that amendment to happen in a more freeform fashion. So firstly, user use cases became user stories, which are theoretically stories that the team tells to each other about how this software is going to work, but in practice are just shorter and ambiguous versions of use case documents, where they are unambiguous in the form of, say, a BDD example or specification. We get the HOR triple, we get the given when then, you know, we get something that is very much in the domain of procedural programming. If this is the existing state of the system, then when this event occurs, then the system will transition into the following state. We may well design our software implementations using objects, classes, or using functions and monads, but we design our socio-technical systems, we design the ways in which people are going to use our software, still using procedural techniques. This has not moved on. Which is not to say that there weren't attempts in the object-oriented community to introduce object-oriented ways of thinking about software and about the systems in which the software lives. You know, if you look at the work of, say, Ward Cunningham and Kent Beck, you definitely see a systems thinking design approach. Read a book like Daniela Meadows' Thinking in Systems, and you would see a lot of relationships between what she says in there and what someone like Kent Beck says when he talks about CRC cards. Now, the idea of a CRC card is not to construct the card, and this is perhaps where a lot of the early attempts to redesign software teams along the lines of object-oriented programming met the resistance of the existing teams who were fairly happy with the way they were working, thank you very much, is that we're not trying to focus on the artifacts. As the Agile Manifesto says, comprehensive documentation is important, but we value working software more. So the goal of the CRC card is not necessarily to write down the class and its responsibilities and its collaborators. It is to give that object, to give the instance of that class, an avatar in the world that you can use for role-playing effectively. Think of CRC cards not as a documentation technique, but as character sheets for a role-playing game. What happens when I try and book a flight? Well, you know, I'm a traveller. I'm going to find out what flights are going to my destination at a particular time. So I'm going to look for a schedule or a timetable or see some way of finding that out. And I'm going to ask it what happens. Well, let's say that this is a sort of oracle. It's a like dynamically active object that can tell me the answer to the question, when is there a flight to my destination? Okay, so it's going to have to find out what the currently scheduled flights are and what airports they fly to and from and which ones of those are within the range of dates I'm interested in, which means that it's going to need to know the range of dates that I'm interested in, and so that oracle is going to have to ask me more questions. And so, you know, as the team goes through using these cards, they can then build that story, they can build that conversation by improvising, by play-acting the roles that these objects are going to take within this system. But to do that, they have to accept and grant autonomy to these objects. They have to say, oh, the Oracle doesn't have enough information to work out which flights are relevant, it's going to ask the user more questions. That is a thing that it does because it receives the message what flights are relevant for my needs, but didn't get told what my needs were. That takes us out of the procedural thing. It's not step one, user enters their desired destination and their date. Step two, user enters their desired originating airport and preferred time of departure. Step three, user does something else. Step four, user clicks on button. It was the conversation between the user and this object, and then the conversation that that object needs to have with the user and with other objects in order to respond to that first question. It requires taking yourself out of the procedural top-down bureaucratic methodology and into an entirely new evolutionary and incremental discovery design approach, where not all of the answers to the questions are known up front, and not all of the answers to the questions can be supplied by the product owner or the customer or their representative or whoever takes that role in a sort of traditionally organized team. Maybe it's that's the pink plane idea. Maybe it's thinking about designing a software system in a different way, thinking about the system, the real world system of people and technology that you're trying to reflect or augment or replace in the software. That would be the pink plane thing. Maybe if we had object-oriented business modeling, or even functional business modeling, or a new approach, non-procedural approach to business modeling, maybe that would be a massive shift in the way that we write software that's so big that it causes us to start solving different problems rather than just adding scale or incremental speed improvements to the ways in which we currently do it. As I said before, I think this has been discovered in many circumstances where something new comes along and you give it to your technology team to make use of, but don't give it to the rest of the company. So you often see behavior-driven development expressed as the idea that tests are written in a human-readable form. Well, the only reason to do that is if a human's going to read them, or potentially if a human's going to write them. And so there's an implied increased collaboration between the people who are making use of these tests, which is presumably the engineering team, and the people who are trying to get some value out of the engineering team, which is presumably, using my scare quote fingers, the business or the customer or whoever. And that this is mediated by these tests. In practice, everybody says, oh yes, well, we don't really expect the customers to deal with that, or we don't think our customers could deal with that, or I've never seen a customer who could deal with that, by which they probably mean they've never tried. And you get the engineering team going to the extra work of writing their tests in a fashion that's different from what they would otherwise do in order to enable a communication that doesn't take place. You also saw it a lot in the sort of like the second wave agile organizations, the ones who heard about the manifesto and then read the in-flight magazine, like the Harvard Business Review or something, that said this agile thing is going to be a big deal, and said, so it turns out that agile is going to be a big deal in software, so you software team, you need to become agile without making the rest of the business agile. You definitely still see that a lot in supposedly agile app development or software development agencies, including web agencies, web consultants, where they want to claim that they're doing agile because you have to in 2020. You can't claim we're doing waterfall, but then you ask what their customer engagement process is, and first they talk to their customers and they find out what the scope of the problem is, and maybe do a little bit of user study or research, and then they go and write a document which they agree with the customer represents the scope of the deliverable and the features that are going to be in this product, and then they agree the schedule, and then agile as fuck, right? Once you've got that contract in place, you can start having your 2-week iterations and your daily stand-ups and your Jira board showing your tickets going across. And then at the end, you deliver the product to the customer and also the invoice. And again, this is changing the way that the engineering team works without changing the way in which everything that the engineering team needs to interface with works. And I'm starting to think that this is kind of the next unexplored area for software engineering, is taking software engineering out of the engineering department or out of the engineering team, making software engineers in general, I mean technical writers, QAs, systems operators, programmers, everybody who works kind of in an engineering department, taking them out of the engineering department and just making them part of or consultants to the solving this problem team. And I'm starting to see companies that are doing this, but I think this is really going to be where the next improvement in engineering techniques comes from, is not in like having a better type system or in having a faster compiler or in having a different DSL for laying out your user interfaces. It's going to be in having a different and perhaps domain-specific software understanding or analysis or problem understanding and analysis framework. One that doesn't just give us sequential text documents or a noticeable gap in a sequential text document that we then translate into objects or noticeably translate into incorrect objects or whatever, but one that allows us to embed using a computer to solve a problem into the problem understanding process. Well, I hope that's been an interesting episode. As ever, I welcome your feedback. You can email grahamlee@acm.org, or you can find me on Twitter, iwasleeg, iwasleeg. Of course, De Programmatica Ipsum, monthly magazine I do with Adrian Kosmachevsky, will be in the show notes. And should you be interested in software development on the Amiga, I run a weekly Twitch stream with Stephen Baker over at DOS Amigans, where we just learn how to write Amiga software, and hopefully you can either learn along with us or help out. So thanks very much for listening, and I will talk to you again next time.